Planned Parenthood of Greater Texas described a traumatizing situation where abortion clinic staff became, in her words, agents of the state's cruelty, repeatedly having to call patients, cancel their abortion appointments, and tell them they didn't know when they could reschedule. At times, patients would be sitting in the waiting room about to have their abortion, and the staff would have to come out and say, I'm sorry, we just got word that this ban is back in place. We're not going to be able to see you. And there was a massive migration of patients in the midst of this deadly pandemic who were forced to travel. Almost 1,000 patients in the month of April alone who sought care in other states. And if you think about that, you know, every time they have to stop at a rest area, every unnecessary encounter with medical staff along the way, that, you know, all is a potential infection risk. And so we saw how half a century worth of attempts to whittle away at abortion access really collided with a deadly pandemic in a way that was just devastating. And you know, I was really inspired by some of the feats of heroism, frankly, that abortion funds, which are groups that exist to try to raise money for people to pay for abortions they couldn't otherwise afford, you know, they moved mountains in order to get people to care. I mean, we're talking about people driving strangers for hours, flying with them on airplanes. We're talking about, you know, not just in Texas, but nationwide, people, you know, getting into cars with strangers and driving them through the South Dakota cornfields and through the Florida Everglades.
This is KBOO Portland.
KBOO is hiring a membership director. Our membership director maintains relationships with KBOO members and listeners, create a process to meet or exceed fundraising goals, and manage the membership database. For a complete job description and instructions on how to apply, visit kboo.fm/employment. Apply by March 15th. KBOO is an affirmative action and equal opportunity employer.
Hello, my friends. This is Life During Wartime.
Tune in to KBOO on Wednesday, March 17th at 10 p.m. for Life During Wartime.
Not just a regular Life During Wartime, playing punk and hardcore, having live bands, and letting you know all the underground DIY punk happenings going on in the Portland metro area.
Just because we're different, they have a spaz attack.
This is a celebration marathon. It's from 10 p.m. to 5:30 a.m. It's our 26th year on the air, so we're having a 25th anniversary celebration.
Looking back at the DJs and bands
Life During Wartime
that have made Life During Wartime a punk institution in Portland, at KBOO, and on the World Wide Web.
Celebrate 25 years of Life During Wartime by donating during our anniversary marathon celebration.
On Wednesday, March 17th, from 10 p.m. to 5:30 a.m.
Here on your community radio station.
KBOO Portland.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News. The Salem Kaiser School District welcomes its youngest students back to the classroom part-time as COVID-19 cases are slowly declining in Oregon. Oregon State University is given the go-ahead to build a wave energy testing facility off the state's coast. And the Biden administration announces new sanctions on Russia for the poisoning of opposition leader Alexei Navalny. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, March 2nd, 2021. I'm Yasmin Kobanoglu. The Oregon Health Authority reported 197 new cases of COVID-19 on Monday, bringing the total number of confirmed and presumptive cases in the state up to 155,787. Oregon health officials also reported 4 new deaths, raising the state's death toll to 2,212. There are currently 132 people hospitalized with COVID-19 statewide, including 27 patients in intensive care units. As of Monday, more than 986,000 first and second doses of a COVID-19 vaccine have been administered across Oregon. OHA expects to receive 34,000 doses of the newly approved Johnson & Johnson vaccine this week. Nationally, the U.S. has reported at least 28.7 million cases of COVID-19. There have been more than 515 deaths across the country. Over the past week, there has been an average of about 67,000 new cases per day, a decrease of 21% from the average 2 weeks earlier. About 16% of the U.S. population has received at least one dose of a COVID-19 vaccine, with 8% fully vaccinated. Texas is now the biggest state in the U.S. to lift its COVID-19 mask mandate. Texas Governor Greg Abbott, a Republican, faced sharp criticism from his party over the mandate and other COVID-19 restrictions. However, the mandate was only ever lightly enforced, even during the worst outbreaks of the pandemic. The state will also remove limits on the number of diners that businesses can serve indoors. The new rules will go into effect March 10th. The move comes as governors across the U.S. have been easing restrictions, despite warnings from health experts that the pandemic is far from over. The World Health Organization said Tuesday that it is unrealistic to expect the COVID-19 pandemic to end this year. WHO Chief Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus said it was regrettable that younger and healthier adults in some wealthier countries are receiving the vaccine before frontline workers in developing countries. He added, quote, "Countries are not in a race with each other. This is a common race against the virus." Globally, the coronavirus pandemic has sickened more than 114 people in nearly every country. At least 2.5 million people have died across the world. Kindergarten and first grade students in the Salem-Keizer district will be returning to the classroom this week. Starting Tuesday, the youngest students in Oregon's second largest school district will return to in-person instruction for 5 hours a day, 2 days per week. Masks will be required and students will be screened before they enter buildings. The hybrid learning model is a combination of in-person instruction at school and distance learning at home. The Salem-Keizer District's plan involves organizing students into small groups or cohorts and having them either attend school in person Tuesdays and Thursdays or Wednesdays and Fridays. Students will attend school online on the days they are not at school in person. Hybrid learning is set to begin for other elementary grades over the next 2 weeks, with all Salem-Keizer Elementary students expected to be back in school part-time by March 16th. For students in middle and high schools, the district said it will expand limited in-person instruction and will share an extended plan for secondary students in the coming weeks. Both Portland Public Schools and the Beaverton School District, Oregon's other large districts, are planning to begin hybrid instruction for elementary students in April. Oregon State University has been given the go-ahead by federal energy regulators for a groundbreaking wave energy testing facility off the coast of the state. The PacWave South project is designed to facilitate and accelerate the development of wave energy technology, which harnesses the motion of the ocean to generate electricity. Oregon is considered to have a higher potential for wave energy generation than both Washington and California. According to a 2011 study by the Electric Power Research Institute, Oregon's available wave energy in the inner shelf alone is enough to power about 28 million homes. This is the first license of its type to be issued in the U.S., and the project has already been given state water quality and coastal zone approvals. While the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission has issued a license to the OSU project, a final review period must pass before construction can begin. Wave energy is considered one of the next frontiers in clean and renewable energy production, but development has been slow and sporadic. OSU's project aims to remedy this by offering a pre-permitted area about 6 nautical miles off the shore of Newport, where wave energy developers can anchor and plug their devices into the grid. Senator Bernie Sanders is pushing to override the Senate parliamentarian. For more, we go to KBOO's Al Kahn.
Senator Bernie Sanders, along with Elizabeth Warren, yesterday requested that Vice President Harris override the ruling by Senate parliamentarian Elizabeth McDonough, which disallows the Reconciliation Act to be used to include a $15 an hour federal minimum wage in the $1.9 billion stimulus relief package proposed by President Biden. Sanders has long been an advocate for the $15 minimum wage, and his capacity as chair of the Senate Budget Committee, he is not backing down on the fight to include it in the stimulus package, saying, quote, "My personal view is that the idea that we have a Senate staffer, a high-ranking staffer, deciding whether 30 million Americans get a pay raise or not is nonsensical." The relief bill passed the House of Representatives without the minimum wage amendment last Friday, with a 219 to 212 vote, which is pretty much along party lines as was expected. Now the bill goes to the Senate. Sanders is pushing hard to add the $15 wage and says he will force a vote on the Senate floor this week to overrule the parliamentarian to allow the wage hike in the reconciliation bill. Sanders has vowed that even if the floor vote does not pass to allow the wage hike in the reconciliation bill, he will not stop his efforts in the fight for 15. As of this time, there has been no comment by Vice President Harris regarding the vote. For KBOO News, I'm Al Khan.
The Biden administration announced new punitive sanctions on senior Russian government figures on Tuesday. The sanctions are in response to the poisoning of opposition leader Alexei Navalny and demand that he be released from detention. The sanctions block access to financial or other assets in the U.S. for seven top officials who are close to Russian President Vladimir Putin. Although the sanctions are largely symbolic, they are the first Biden administration action against Russia. Some U.S. officials say Biden is signaling that his administration plans to treat Russia differently than the previous one. The U.S. also announced new export restrictions on items that could be used to manufacture chemical weapons. Navalny, the Russian opposition leader, was poisoned in August of 2020 with the nerve agent Novichok, which was developed as a Soviet weapon of war. He recovered in Germany but was jailed upon his return to Moscow in January. He was sentenced to more than 2 years in prison on what human rights advocates say are manufactured charges. Immigrants' rights advocates are praising the Biden administration's announcement on Monday that families who have been separated at the border in the past can reunite here in the U.S. while they pursue their immigration cases. Suzanne Potter has more on the story with the Public News Service.
Human rights advocates are applauding a new Biden administration policy to allow children who remain in U.S. custody after being separated from their parents at the border to reunite with them in the U.S. or in their country of origin. Under President Donald Trump, parents were deported without their children, and hundreds of kids remain in U.S. care. Deborah Weinstein with the Coalition on Human Needs says the separations harmed children and amounted to a shocking moral failure.
What the Trump administration did in forcing children and families apart was unspeakably cruel, and it was contrary to our moral code and to the rule of law. The Biden administration is taking a necessary and a humane step.
Weinstein says the government should consider restitution and look at giving the families a pathway to citizenship. It is unclear if families that already have been reunited abroad will be allowed to come to the U.S. while they pursue their claims of asylum. Opponents of the change say it will encourage a new surge of asylum seekers at the border. Cecia Alvarado is Nevada State Director for the nonprofit Mi Familia Vota. She says this is an important win for the immigrant community.
I'm a mother, and I'm also an immigrant. Just the thought of it, to be separated from my daughter, it's terrifying. I think they deserve to have an opportunity to be here, to heal, to receive treatment for the traumas, to be heard.
The Department of Homeland Security is expected to release more details of the policy in the coming weeks. The UNLV Immigration Clinic recently helped a family regain custody of a child, but does not currently represent any families still trying to reunite. For Public News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
FBI Director Christopher Wray testified about the January 6th Capitol riot before a Senate panel today. KBOO's Al Khan has more on the story.
FBI Director Christopher Wray testified before a Senate panel today regarding the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol building. During his testimony, Wray denounced rumors that the attack was orchestrated by members of leftist groups. Director Wray stated so far most of the people that have been arrested have connections with so-called militia groups and white supremacists. And so far, there is no evidence to suggest that any of those involved were connected to anarchist groups or have any connection to Antifa, as Trump's lawyers and prominent politicians such as Mark Getz have speculated. Wray began his testimony condemning the actions of the rioters, calling their behavior criminal, and that it has no place in our democracy. Wray also spoke about the FBI's warning prior to the attack, shared in the intelligence report known as the NoFolk Memo, which detailed online communications occurring before the January 6th attack. He said after receiving the information from the agency's Norfolk, Virginia field office, it was shared with the Joint Terrorism Task Force through email, and verbal briefings were held at the Washington, D.C. field office, along with FBI headquarters, which included D.C. police. This is in direct contradiction to last week's testimony from law enforcement from around the Capitol area, which blamed lack of security on insufficient intelligence. As to the progress of the investigation into the riot, Ray said that the Bureau has received more than 270,000 tips from digital media, and hundreds of investigations are ongoing in all but one of the agency's 56 field offices across the country. And to date, more than 300 people have been arrested by the FBI and its partner agencies. For KBU News, I'm Al Khan.
You're listening to the KBU Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report on the campaign to recall Clackamas County Commissioner Tootie Smith, followed by COVID Noise Filter, examining the latest news on the coronavirus pandemic. Then at 6, it's Transpositive PDX. And at 7, Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be partly cloudy with a low of 37 degrees. Tomorrow will again be partly cloudy with a high of 60 degrees. Today in history, in 1917, barely a month after the U.S. enters World War I, President Woodrow Wilson signs the Jones-Shafroth Act, granting U.S. citizenship to the inhabitants of Puerto Rico. As citizens, Puerto Ricans could now join the U.S. Army, but few chose to do so. 2 months later, Wilson signed a compulsory military service act, and 20,000 Puerto Ricans were eventually drafted to serve in World War I. The quote of the day is from American civil rights and women's rights activist Dorothy Height, who said, quote, "Civil rights are civil rights. There are no persons who are not entitled to their civil rights. We have to recognize that we have a long way to go, but we have to go that way together." President Joe Biden meets with Mexican President Andres Manuel López Obrador. DHS Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas says separated immigrant families may be able to stay in the U.S., and Senator Elizabeth Warren introduces legislation for a wealth tax. With more on the story, it's Laura Rosbrow Tellum with 2021 Talks.
Welcome to 2021 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times. The Biden administration will explore allowing migrant families separated under the Trump administration to reunite and stay in the U.S. Secretary of the Department of Homeland Security, Alejandro Mayorkas, made the announcement Monday.
We are hoping to reunite the families either here or in the country of origin. And if, in fact, they seek to reunite here in the United States, we will explore lawful pathways for them to remain in the United States.
Mayorkas, who also chairs a new family separation task force, says so far they have reunited more than 100 families. Meanwhile, President Joe Biden met virtually with Mexican President Andres Manuel López Obrador on Monday to discuss trade, COVID-19, and immigration.
It's great to be with you, Mr. President.
While few details were released, Biden told a reporter they would talk about whether to send COVID-19 vaccines to Mexico. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki took some heat for the administration's lack of action against Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman for his involvement in the murder of journalist Jamal Khashoggi. She stressed they had sanctioned the entire Rapid Intervention Force, a unit of the Saudi Royal Guard, and a senior Saudi intelligence official. Al-Psaki said it would be rare to sanction the leader of a country where the U.S. has diplomatic ties. She did not rule it out.
We are going to be, of course, hold the option of holding, Saudi Arabia to their commitment to put reforms in place and make progress moving forward.
Psaki also commented on next steps for raising the minimum wage, since it was left out of the Senate COVID relief bill.
But we don't have a clear answer on what that looks like at this point. It just remains a commitment and something he will use his political capital to get done.
Over the weekend, Senate Democratic leaders retreated without announcing a way to salvage this effort. More than 5,000 Amazon workers in Alabama are voting this week on unionizing, and they got a big boost from a supportive video from President Biden. If they're successful, they'll be the first of Amazon's 400,000 American workers to join a union. On the other end of the wealth spectrum, Senator Elizabeth Warren of Massachusetts and House colleagues introduced legislation to create an ultra-millionaire tax.
A 2-cent wealth tax would just help level the playing field a little bit.
This tax would target those with more than $50 million in assets and tax 2 cents for every dollar after $50 million. In other words, it's a 2% tax for the ultra-wealthy on top of any income or capital gains taxes they currently pay. And for billionaires, this tax would be 3%. Finally, a Senate panel voted to recommend Merrick Garland's confirmation as Attorney General. The full Senate will hold a vote soon. And the Senate confirmed Miguel A. Cardona for Education Secretary. For Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Laura Rosbrow-Tellum. Thanks for listening.
A new development in the tribal fight to protect Oak Flat from mining, a South Dakota tribe eases reservation checkpoint restrictions, and tribes are part of plans to distribute single-dose COVID-19 vaccines. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Tonto National Forest in Arizona will be rescinding the final environmental review that triggered the land swap of Oak Flat, a sacred site, to a mining company. Emma Gibson from Arizona Public Media reports.
If the land transfer takes place, the proposed copper mine would be one of the largest in the country, one day transforming Oak Flat into a crater. Attorney Luke Goodrich is representing Apache Stronghold, one of the groups opposing the transfer. He calls the rescinded review a temporary retreat.
But a temporary retreat doesn't solve the problem. The government is still planning to transfer and destroy Oak Flat, and Oak Flat and the Apaches still need legal protection.
Soon after, the federal government responded to an emergency injunction filing on the project. It says it doesn't think there's a need for it, especially since the land exchange will probably be delayed by the rescinded final review. It says a change in land title doesn't pose an immediate harm to the site, and mining is years away. For National Native News, I'm Emma Gibson.
The country's leading infectious disease expert, Dr. Anthony Fauci, says tribal nations will be able to get single-dose COVID-19 vaccines being approved by the federal government. Over the weekend, the U.S. authorized Johnson & Johnson's single-shot vaccine.
I just have been in consultation with our medical team, and the plan for the distribution of the J&J vaccine will that it will be equitably distributed in exactly the same way that the Moderna and the Pfizer vaccines have been distributed. It's based on population per state, and then when you get tribal nations, the same mechanism that got the Moderna and the Pfizer to you will get the J&J to you.
Tribes across the country have been using the 2-dose vaccines with distribution through the Indian Health Service or states. IHS officials ahead of J&J approval last week said the IHS will use all available vaccines authorized by the government. Fauci is serving as chief medical advisor to President Biden, leading the administration's COVID-19 response team. The Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe in South Dakota is relaxing checkpoint restrictions on the reservation to allow vehicles through regardless of residency or business. The checkpoints have been part of the tribe's COVID-19 emergency response. The decision comes after consultation with medical professionals, the Public Health Task Force, and as COVID-19 vaccinations take place in the community. Checkpoints will remain as part of contact tracing. Spokesperson Remy Baldeagle says the restrictions may change due to potential outbreaks.
If, for instance, a hotspot happened on a community off the reservation and there was an outbreak, then because there's different variances of the virus that are coming out, if an outbreak happens on a community off the reservation, we may still, you know, go back to those more strict applications in regards to that particular area.
Last year, tribal checkpoints faced scrutiny by the state's governor, Kristi Noem, who said they interfered with interstate commerce. Tribes kept their checkpoints, failing to reach an agreement with the state. Public health teams in Colorado are collaborating with the Southern Ute Tribe for a mobile COVID-19 testing event on the reservation and surrounding community Tuesday to gather data on the virus. Over the weekend, the tribe confirmed the discovery of the California COVID-19 variant on the reservation. Its origin is currently under investigation. It was found in a sample from an individual with COVID-19 who recently died. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Cloud seeding can boost mountain snowpack. The controversial practice has shown promise in recent studies. Dr. Anthony Leisowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Leisowitz, and this is Climate Connections. In the spring, melting snowpack in the Rocky Mountains feeds the Colorado River, which supplies drinking water to 40 million people across 7 states. But as the climate warms, snowpack is shrinking, prompting concerns over water shortages. One technique that can help increase precipitation is called cloud seeding. It's been used in some areas since the 1950s. A machine or airplane releases particles, such as silver iodide, into developing storm clouds. The particles attract molecules of water vapor, and if the conditions are right, those droplets form more rain or snow. Mohammed Mahmoud is with the Central Arizona Water Conservation District, which has funded cloud seeding projects in the Rocky Mountains for years.
The type of cloud seeding we're interested in is winter cloud seeding, and what that does is enhance the snowpack so that ultimately in the spring, that enhanced snowpack can increase the runoff that water users rely on downstream.
The practice remains controversial, but researchers have found that cloud seeding can increase the amount of precipitation that falls in a storm by up to 15%, so it can help reduce the impact of climate change on critical water supplies. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
A new map explores reforestation across the country. Because of the carbon they absorb, trees are an important tool in fighting climate change. Eric Tegedoff has more on the story with the Public News Service.
A new tool identifies the potential for replanting trees in Idaho and across the country. The Nature Conservancy and American Forest Reforestation Hub is a comprehensive look at county-level opportunities for planting trees where they once grew. It finds there is nearly 4.3 million acres of formerly forested land in Idaho. The Nature Conservancy's senior forest reforestation scientist, Susan Cook Patton, says replanting trees is one means for addressing climate change.
The point of this work is to say, okay, here is one tool. Let's break it further down into 10 different menu items that then you could pick what works best for your community, for your county, for your state.
Reforesting Idaho would absorb more than 4.3 million cubic tons of carbon from the atmosphere per year, enough to consume the emissions of about 940,000 cars annually. When identifying areas ripe for reforestation, the map filters the most promising places based on factors such as how the land is currently used and who owns it. Cook Patton says Idaho has many opportunities across different land categories, such as marginal cropland and shrubland. Reforestation also can be important in areas scarred by wildfires, an increasing threat in the Northwest because of climate change. Cook Patton says forests can grow back on their own, but sometimes need intervention to weather future fires.
That can help stabilize the soil and get the system to come back more rapidly so that we can enjoy our forested areas again.
The Nature Conservancy in Idaho is partnering with the City of Boise on its City of Trees Challenge, which aims to plant a tree for every household and a seedling for every resident. Cook Patton says urban tree planting has many upsides.
We can really benefit from having those trees close to our homes for all the cooling benefits and biodiversity and just general emotional well-being to see a tree out our window.
For Public News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, March 2nd, 2021. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Al Kahn, the producer is Yasmin Kobanoglu, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Antonia Gonzalez, Suzanne Potter, Laura Rosbrow-Tellum, Eric Tegedoff, and Dr. Anthony Leisowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Yasmin Kobanoglu. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO. At 8, it's Wednesday Talk Radio, news and commentary on local, national, and international issues. At 9, Inside Washington County with Rob Solomon brings residents the information they need to fully engage with issues in their community. At 10, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. Then at 11, it's The Bike Show, bringing you news and views of cycling in Portland and beyond. All of these KBOO programs, including the evening news, are made possible by support from our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or use our mobile app and click on Donate. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth. We will be diving into the campaign to recall Clackamas County Commissioner Tootie Smith.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Joining me today is Ana Tejerina Esquino, who is part of a movement to remove Clackamas County Board of Commissioners Chair Tootie Smith. Tell me a little bit about why you are all working to remove Tootie Smith.
It's a layered issue. I got involved with an internet group that was forming to recall her actually before she took office. In November, she made some very public statements regarding COVID. She was talking about how she would invite as many people as would come to her house for Thanksgiving in defiance of orders. And this was, you know, as an elected official. And then she even went on Fox News and referred to the COVID restrictions as treating Oregonians as second-rate slaves. And, you know, right away from that moment, you could tell that Tootie Smith was at least really out of touch. And it wasn't until I dove a little deeper and started talking to a lot of neighbors in a lot of different Facebook groups and online that I learned, you know, more about her background and some of the concerning history regarding Tootie Smith. And then, you know, now the movement to recall her has really grown also because of her support of Mark Scholl, one of the new incoming commissioners who had, you know, a really extensive and worrying amount of racist, Islamophobic, anti-LGBTQ comments, like a lot of really bigoted comments. And though the entire commission voted to censure him, she has been supporting him along the way and now has changed some of the way that the business meetings are held to try and limit some public comments. So, you know, it started because I thought her posts about COVID were worrying. And then when I reached out as a constituent, I essentially got insulted and then blocked. And I just felt like that's really not an appropriate way for a representative to speak to people in their county. And since then, it's grown. Unfortunately, Tootie has just given us more reasons that we believe she should not be our elected official.
Could you go in a little more depth into that interaction you had with Tootie Smith when you tried to ask her some of these questions?
Yeah. So, you know, and it's a lot of different people, both on Facebook and on Twitter, because she is actually fairly active online. So commenting on her posts, and I try and approach things first from an educational point. I graduated with an engineering background. I've been very fortunate to get to learn under some experts in air quality, and I knew a lot of the science relating COVID transmission. So when she would post things about how, you know, it was perfectly safe to open restaurants now, and I would say, you know, no, there's like these reasons why it is not as safe. There's these reasons why not being able to wear a mask indoors presents a lot of complications. And she often didn't respond at all to our comments or a lot of the comments that were disagreeing with her. And she would have a lot of her, I would assume, followers respond mean things, and then you get blocked off the page. And to this day, our Facebook group has a lot of different instances of like, oh, today I was blocked by Tootie again. Me, I was just commenting on her own posts about reopening Oregon to try and at first start with like, no, I'm sorry, that is actually just not true. No, you can't just give people UV light wands and tell them to disinfect their hands with it. That's a very, very dangerous thing to say. She had that in her white paper. And she didn't actually respond to me directly ever. The only time she responded to a comment I have said directly was in a business meeting. She did respond after one of my public comments.
It does seem like Tootie Smith is trying to limit the access of her constituents to her by imposing a limit on the amount of time that guests have to speak in these public meetings. It also sounds like there are already limits to the amount of time that the public has to speak in these meetings in Multnomah County and in Washington, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I know in the Clackamas County business meeting, we are currently given 3 minutes. She has talked about in meetings trying to limit that to 2, and then they actually did pass a thing that I think is effective this Tuesday. Now you have to register to speak, and it can't be live that you're going to raise your hand in the Zoom recording. You have to register ahead of time, and you have to tell them what you're going to be speaking on. And I think that that's a part of the push as well for her to hear less of the comments of the constituents that are, you know, having problems.
I also wanted to add that Tootie Smith has created a proposed plan to reopen Clackamas County. Part of that plan involves disregarding scientific evidence about COVID-19. If I could just quote that real quick, Tootie Smith wrote in her proposal that it could be concluded that COVID-19 is on par with other diseases and the threat of higher infection and mortality rate assumed by university models did not meet expectations. So it does sound like denial of COVID science is something that's been pretty persistent in her tenure.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think what you're referring to is the white paper she published. Reading that as a person that understood a lot of the science as to how to mitigate risks for COVID, it is scary. Her number one suggestion was to stay healthy so your immune system will be strong. And like, you know, reading that as a scientist, as an engineer, you know, I know that politics is behind that statement, but it's also not a real suggestion. Like, that is, telling someone to be healthier is not going to help it.
So you mentioned earlier that part of how this push began was you were initially repulsed by some of the things she had said surrounding COVID-19 and her plans to have a Thanksgiving meal that didn't practice proper social distancing. And then you mentioned that you looked into her history. Tootie Smith was elected to the County Board of Commissioners before in 2012 as a Tea Party candidate, correct?
Correct.
And she also served in the Oregon State House.
Correct. Yeah, she's been active in Oregon politics for quite some time. And if you track her involvement with Timber Unity, a group that, you know, has a lot of political push in Oregon and the Republican Party primarily, she's been around for a very, very long time. So yeah, there's quite a bit to look back on and be concerned about.
Could you speak a little bit more to some things in her political history?
Okay, so there's a lot of different avenues I could take. There's just some that are like that make me question her integrity, and then there's several that make me think that she might not be a good representative in certain things. One, she is very anti-transit. For me, that's really important. I believe that climate change is a problem that we must solve, and I believe it is impossible to solve that problem without addressing public transportation. Tootie Smith fought the yellow line very, very strongly, and she fights a lot of these measures that she feels are coming from Metro trying to impede on Clackamas County's lifestyle, and those are troubling for me as a person that really, really cares about climate change. There is also things that make me question her integrity as a human being. There is some documentation online, and there's actually a website called tootiewatch.com that has compiled a lot of these things that Tootie has done in the past. They actually have a video vault as well. And she has a history of belittling her constituents. There was, I think, and I wish I knew the exact scenario, but I would have to look it up, but there was a situation where she was essentially bullying high schoolers to try and stop them from having a pride parade. She was outing gay people in her community in Malala. Like, a lot of these things that I believe are a true sign of a problem with someone's character. Yeah, so she has quite a few of those actions that make her unfit to serve, both because of her integrity and because of some political opinions that I think are limiting progress here.
The campaign to remove Tootie Smith is connected to the campaign to move Mark Scholl, who Tootie Smith has supported in the past.
Mark Scholl has made some pretty concerning comments. And it's actually, so we have one volunteer, her name is Chris Waller, and she's active in Oregon government as well. And she actually found a lot of Marshall's posts when she was digging around for Tootie Smith. She is big into documentation, and thank goodness there are people like her, because she was the person that compiled this Tootie Watch website. The blog originally was called Documenting Marshall's Racism, but now it is on the Recall Marshall page. And she found a lot of those comments that Mr. Scholl had made. I don't know if you've read the comments. They're pretty gross. They're not comments that you're like, yeah, I could see how that is inappropriate because they don't know the proper language nowadays, right? Like, no, they are blatantly Islamophobic. He is so Islamophobic in his comments that it makes you almost feel bad reading them out loud. So that became a priority for us to also get Scholl out. And though originally every Clackamas County commissioner voted to censure Marshall, including Tootie Smith and Marshall himself. And censuring is essentially making a statement, but not really doing anything. It is a political move to say that you disagree with the words that Marshall had made. You disagree with these statements. But when Marshall refused to resign, and when community members started to attend these business meetings to talk about how they wanted Mark Scholl to resign and how these comments are not an appropriate communication from a representative, that's when you could see Tootie start to come to his defense. And then, like, I've made a few public statements myself where I will address both of them, and she has not reacted too well to that. So yeah, we are working together with the Recall Marshall group. We have separate commissions, and they did form independently with different neighbors. But I think a lot of the people that wanted to see Scholl gone saw Tootie's actions in trying to support him. She blocked a vote to strip his salary, even after a clarification was on the table from their lawyer that they were allowed, that this was a motion that was allowed. Once all those things started happening, we saw the need to bring our commissions together, since we were going to be targeting a lot of the same people. And a recall campaign that's in countywide in the Clackamas County, we would need to collect close to 36,000 signatures. And that's probably closer to 40, because after the verification process, some aren't able to be counted for different reasons. So we want to work together because it's a monumental amount of work to get 40,000 signatures, and because we believe that we can't move Clackamas County politics forward with just removing one. You know, we need commissioners that have integrity, and that would require both of them to be off the board.
Does Tootie Smith enjoy the support of good portion of Clackamas County?
Yeah, I mean, she is very strongly supported by Timber Unity, and I think she does really represent the interests of the timber companies in Oregon. I know that there are a lot of citizens in Clackamas County that work for the timber industry and that will likely, you know, feel represented by Tootie. I know a lot of people are concerned about higher taxes, but I personally believe that some of the problems with her integrity, some of the belittling situations, some of the trying to silence situations, some of the supporting, you know, racism on the part of her support of Mark Scholl, like, those should not be partisan problems. So hopefully we will have a lot of Clackamas County voters that will not be supporting those parts of Tootie Smith.
Well, thanks for joining me today.
Yeah, thank you for having me. It is definitely happening very quickly. It has been really, really great to meet so many neighbors. That is one of the things that has been an unexpected delight for me, because I have, one, gotten to listen to so much public testimony from neighbors that literally has brought me hearing families that live in Clackamas County that have made their lives here, that are concerned about things that are happening. Now working with a lot of people that want to volunteer locally, some that I know are my neighbors, you know, and I've met them online, and I've now gotten this little network of people in Clackamas County that want politicians that are going to be honest with them, that want politicians that are going to consider our best interests. Like, the community support at this has been absolutely, absolutely incredible. So it's nice that we're we're getting to connect, even if it is to remove representatives that we think are not serving us.
Thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you, Ethan.
From KBOO News, I'm Ethan Sandwise.
That was Ethan Sandwise speaking with Ana Tijerina Esquino, the chief petitioner on the campaign to recall Clackamas County Commissioner Tootie Smith. Find the full story and our episode notes online at kboo.fm/newsindepth. Now it's COVID Noise Filter, unpacking the latest coronavirus news with infectious disease and community health experts.
Hi, my name is Dr. Mark Allen Derry, and I'm an infectious diseases specialist in New Orleans.
Hi, my name is Doc Griggs, and I'm a community medicine doctor and health literacy expert. This is the Noise Filter Podcast, where an infectious diseases physician,
that's me, and a health literacy and communications expert,
that's me, talk about what you need to know about COVID-19.
You can find more information about this show and our other daily live updates and Q&A show at noisefiltershow.com.
So let's get started.
All right, welcome to Noise Filter. This is Dr. Mark Allen Derry. Doc Griggs is not able to be with us today. So this is one of my favorite segments in which I get to review some of the interesting public health research that has come out in the past week. So let's go ahead and get started. Okay, so in late January, the CDC actually came out with four incredible studies. Actually, two of them were studies that were looking at schools. One was a viewpoint, and then one was looking at a super spreading event. I'm just going to go over them really quickly. Essentially, what they did was they looked at one school in Mississippi, and what they did was they looked at about 400 children, and they looked at those that had COVID versus those that didn't have COVID. And what they found, amazingly enough, was that children who attended schools, especially schools where they were masked and also socially distanced, that actually protected them from COVID. But if children were more likely to have a close contact with a COVID-19 case, let's say like a sick sibling or a parent at home, or they went to social gatherings like parties or weddings, or they went to other child gatherings such as birthday parties or play dates, that actually put them at risk for COVID. So essentially what they found was that close contacts with persons with COVID and gatherings outside of school contribute to COVID-19, whereas being in school actually protected children from COVID-19. So it really does speak to the importance of, if you do school appropriately, where you mask and you socially distance, you're going to find that transmission is almost minimal. The same evaluation was done in 17 rural schools in Wisconsin. The schools had an amazing masking culture where there was almost 95% masking adherence amongst students. And what they found was that there was 191 cases among students in these 17 schools, and they were able to track just 4% of those cases were linked to in-school spread. Even though cases were going up in the communities around their school, again, what they found was that with masking requirements and student cohorting, transmission risk within schools appeared to be low, suggesting that schools might be able to safely open with appropriate mitigation efforts in place. So that prompted them to put an article in the Journal of the American Medical Association. And what they essentially said in this viewpoint was that when precautions were in place, they found that scant transmission of COVID occurred in schools. And what they said was essentially, if you are committing to policies that prevent COVID-19 transmission, especially in communities and in schools, this will help ensure future social and academic welfare of all students. Now, the last study that they published was looking at a wrestling event that occurred in December 2020 in Florida. There was about 10 schools from three counties, and there was no masking, especially no masking while they were wrestling. There was a total of 130 wrestlers, coaches, and referees. And what they found was, of those that they were able to find, so they couldn't contact trace everybody, but a total of 50 of those that they were able to find, 54 of the 130 attendees were tested, and about 38 of them were positive. So there was obviously multiple cases of students and family members who were not at the wrestling match that were positive, and unfortunately, there was an individual who was over the age of 50 who died. So in the end of this one super spreading event, right, they found that there was 1,700 cases of classroom learning that was lost from quarantine of not just infected people, but those others that they may have also come in contact with. Outbreaks amongst athletes participating in high contact sports can impact in-person learning for all students and increase risk for secondary in school and community transmission with potentially severe outcomes from including death. I really of the belief, and we have been of the belief, that these indoor sporting events should be put on pause right now while we are still navigating our way through this pandemic, especially now that we have these new viral variants. This next study was a really interesting one. It's one that I'm particularly interested in because I'm a public health practitioner here in my local New Orleans area. And so I'm oftentimes questioned with how long somebody's infectious for or what have you. So these infectious study periods are really interesting for me. And this is yet another one. And we're starting to see, this is the third or fourth one that has hit my radar. So in other words, these were really well-designed studies that all the results are more or less the same. All right, because that's what science is, right? In science, we are trying to look for continuity of information. So what they did here was essentially they're trying to answer the questions, how long is a person with COVID infectious? These were researchers out of China, so they looked at 21 hospitalized patients, and they were frequently tested by both PCR as well as viral culture. Now, viral culture is important because viral culture will tell you whether or not the virus is alive, whereas PCR just tells you presence or absence of virus. The viral culture tells you whether or not it's alive. So what they actually found was that the average patient stopped being contagious by day 7 after onset of symptoms. So that's amazing. So we usually say about day 10 is what we usually say. What they found, though, was here was that they did find one person who was continuing to be contagious about 12 days after the beginning of symptoms. Again, this is why I think that if we just kind of cut the difference and say 10 days after onset of symptoms. So if you are symptomatic with COVID-19, about 10 days after you develop your symptoms is pretty much when you stop being contagious. Now, the important part of the study also is that if you have a PCR test, you can continue to be PCR positive for months afterwards. So the positive PCR doesn't tell you whether or not you're contagious. The positive PCR just tells you whether or not you still have viral activity in your oral pharynx or your nasal pharynx. So in other words, in your mouth or your nose. So, but we know that that virus is not alive after about 10 days or so. So there's really no reason to go get a test to cure after you get a positive test. So anytime an employer tries to get one of my patients to get a test to cure or a second test for COVID to show that they're negative for PCR, I always write a note saying that that's not necessary and that the CDC does not recommend that because, again, these PCR tests can be positive for up to 30 or even longer days afterwards. The next two studies that came out also at the end of January also basically looked at the Moderna vaccine. And when they looked at the Moderna vaccine against the virus that emerged out of South Africa, which is referred to as B1351, what they showed was that it reduces vaccine-induced antibodies by a factor of 6. And the third study that came out also pretty much was released on the same day. They looked at both the Moderna vaccine and Pfizer vaccine. And when they looked at antibodies for Moderna and Pfizer, when they tested it against the B1351 viral variant or the variant that emerged out of South Africa, again, they found that there was a 6 to 9 times decrease in potency of antibodies. In other words, the vaccine-induced antibodies are weakened against these new viral variants. There's still a lot more new information we have to learn about this, and we will continue to report about these as we get more information. All right, so this next study is looking at viral evolution, and this is really fascinating. And this was a real-time study that we can actually see how a virus evolves in one person over a period of time. And so let me go through this. It's a little bit techy in terms of science, but if you hang with me, I promise you it delivers, because this study shows us how the viral variants have emerged. So essentially what they looked at was an individual who is immunocompromised. They didn't tell us what the immunocompromised disease that they had, but they told them they had a compromised immune system. They had COVID. They were in the hospital for about 101 days, and unfortunately, they passed away. So what they did is they tracked the case rigorously and performed careful genetic analysis on the patient's virus repeatedly. And on about day 60, what they did was they gave the patient convalescent plasma. So convalescent plasma, remember, that's where you get antibodies from somebody else that had coronavirus. And so what they found was, because this person was immunocompromised, they didn't mount a very good antibody response. So it made sense that they would give somebody else's antibodies to see if that helped. And what they found was that the virus actually rebounded. So the antibodies pretty much took care of all of the standard virus, right? All of that we refer to it as wild type virus. It was all basically the virus that was all the generic virus. And as a result of that generic virus being wiped away, it created an opening. We refer to that opening as called an ecological niche. And that niche was filled by a bunch of mutant viruses. Yeah. So giving convalescent plasma at day 60 gave rise to significant mutant viruses. Now, they did it again at day 90, and it gave rise to even more viruses. And some of those viruses are going to peter out, but some of those viruses can continue on. And so you can see here how a person who's immunocompromised could potentially give rise to these viral variants. And that's how we think that we've seen that. Now, of course, this is just one study, but it does nicely illustrate the process of natural selection. The viral variants, the B117 that we're seeing now, is thought to have emerged from a similar process like this, as we've seen with the B1351 and P1 out of Brazil as well. So I love these viral evolution and development studies, and I'll certainly keep you up to date with those. So this next set of studies was looking at masking, and of course, the CDC recently released some studies where they looked at some dummies, and they put different types of masking, and they simulated coughing from the dummies. And what they found was that like a 3-ply surgical mask blocked about 42% of particles from a simulated cough. A 3-ply cloth mask blocked about 44%, but a cloth mask and a medical mask, so in other words, a cloth mask covering a medical mask, blocked about 92% of particles. So that's somebody breathing out. What about somebody breathing in? What they found was that a double mask protected you about 82% of the time, and a knotted mask, that's when you do the little knot and tuck method. I would definitely, if that's something that you're interested in looking at, please go online, and there's a number of websites that actually can show you how the knot and tuck method works. So in essence, a double masking or better fitted mask are important tools in fighting the pandemic. And we do know how important it is, masking is. And I think given these new viral variants, double masking is so important. Okay, so now the second study that the CDC released about a week ago or so was looking at state mask mandates. So what they did was they took a number of states and they compared them with states that didn't have mask mandates. And what they found was that prior to having mask mandates, when they broke it down into ages of those individuals that were hospitalized, in other words, groups of ages, so those that were young, middle-aged, or older, and hospitalizations, prior to states that had mask mandates, they all had very similar hospitalizations between young individuals, middle-aged individuals, and older individuals. And according to this grouping, I'm middle-aged. Okay. All right. Anyway, what they found was that after states had mask mandates, without question, there was a significant drop in the young and middle-aged individuals with respect to hospitalizations. So essentially what they found was that wearing a mask does reduce exposure, transmission, and strain on a healthcare system with direct effects on COVID-19 morbidity and associated mortality. So we do know that state mask mandates work, and we do encourage all states to have them. Just as a reminder that COVID-19 and the human immunodeficiency virus do share the same risk factors. Doc Griggs?
Thanks for listening to the Noise Filter Daily Podcast.
Hey, Doc Griggs, any last words?
Remember, get checked, get fit, get moving. And remember to get some rest to boost your immune system. And Doc?
Protect yourself and others by staying home, and please wear masks when you go outside. Remember, health is a human right.
Listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open